I'm Davina, and welcome to the first episode of What Will I Be When I Grow Up? On our show today, we have with us Michelle Gunasilan, who works as an aid worker at an international organization. Michelle and I met in London in 2009 when she was studying at the London School of Economics and I was working at SOAS. Since then, Michelle has worked in Ethiopia, Myanmar, Yemen, Switzerland, and Syria. She's here today to tell us about how she got this job in the first place.
Hello, Davina. Nice to see you again.
Hello, Michelle. Really nice to see you. So today, Michelle, I just want to ask you a couple of questions about what life is like as an aid worker, but also just to explore your history, how you got here. So we'll start perhaps with a little bit about your early education. Do you want to tell us about school, university?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in the beautiful suburb of Taman Melawati. I went to school in Sekolah Menengah Taman Melawati. I was really active in English club and debate team, which I think we discussed before. So I had always had an interest in, looking at the world in like differing positions and also adjusting my opinions, which then kind of spurred me on to apply for what was called Antara Budaya Malaysia. I'm not sure if it's now back to AFS or it is Antara Budaya, but it's foreign exchange scholarship that I got from HSBC. And I ended up spending a year after my SPM in Buffalo, New York. So I went there for a year and then I came back, ended up going to Tar College for a year, which was also a very interesting experience. And finally ended up settling on Taylor's College to do my bachelor's in journalism. They don't have the program now, but it was a twinning with University Science Malaysia, or USM. And I think it is really one of the best programs. They don't have it now, but I think it was super amazing because you really had like strong professors who were from the communication school, which is, you know, they have their own production kind of room and like courses and stuff. So I was really happy to do that because you learn very quickly about a lot of the laws that govern like media and the press. And I think to have that local feel was excellent. Right after that, I ended up joining magazines mainly. Most of them are kind of defunct now. So there was Off the Edge, which was from The Edge. It was a pullout, a lifestyle business arts pullout. And it was also really kind of revolutionary at that point. You know, we had like very interesting covers and interesting issues that were not really discussed in the mainstream press in Malaysia at the time. So this was like, what is it now? 14 years ago. So things are not as open as they are now. And then I had many columns and stuff in local magazines, ranging from Tatler, Off the Edge, Clue, also a wonderful magazine from our youth. Yeah, and then eventually kind of quit all of this to move into aid work.
I remember in our conversations, though, that you mentioned that you were blogging from a very young age. So did you do this whilst you were at university and college?
Actually, the blog thing started when I was, 19, when I came back from the States. I think living there, and I lived in an area with like a lot of inner city crime and violence, I think that changed me a lot, you could say, into thinking about the world in a lot of different ways, I suppose. So it started when I got back here. And of course, you know, I'm Malaysian Indian. And I didn't really feel that there were many options representing how I felt about politics or how I saw the world. So I started blogging a lot. And bearing in mind back then, there was also very few blogs. So it was me and another friend, and we had a blog called Suara Malaysia, and we talked about politics. So that was really interesting for me because also I got into a lot of trouble with family and friends and college professors. So yeah, that was the start, like you could say, of like writing informally, I guess, not published. Yeah.
And so, you know, after a number of years as a journalist, we obviously met when you were a Chief Evening Scholar in London. So what was your inspiration behind applying for the scholarship in the first place?
So I worked then also now for a defunct magazine called Tell Magazine, and I was the features writer. So I was allowed to write a lot of long form pieces about human rights, human interest stories, and my specialty was stuff like that, and also a lot of government and politics. So what had happened was, I think this was around the time of, I cannot remember the city mayor then. I want to say Adnan Mansour, but maybe I'm wrong. I cannot remember now exactly. But there was a policy, the zero squatter policy. So I remember going to one of these old villages in KL, you know, the kind that's set up because there is a kind of tacit approval between the government and the people. So that, like, water and electricity have been provided in this place. People have settled for like 30 years at a time. And then now, because they have this new policy, they were going to be removed of this land. And I remember going there and thinking to myself, this is so weird and bizarre. Because it's like, it's a small village that was actually, you know where Hock Chuen supermarket is? Like, it's just behind on the road. It's pretty central. And everyone is being evicted. And I actually saw all these things happening. And then the villagers and the children of the village ended up doing a lot of campaigning and a lot of different things to kind of bring light to what was happening to them. And I thought this was like such a wonderful example of like how civil society, if you have a bunch of people actually behind a certain cause, it would be so interesting. But I remember filing the story and asking my editor if I could go back and go help them. And then she told me, like, you know, that's not your role. Your role is to write, and then you have to kind of let it go. Because obviously that wouldn't be, it wouldn't be what a journalist does, basically. I mean, a lot of us have issues with this, like you have to report, but then kind of also be okay after that because you're not an active participant. You write about what happens. And I thought to myself, like, look, I don't want to continue just writing about it. I want to actually do something about things that matter. So I then applied for the She Evening. Interestingly, I started off applying for government and politics. And halfway through, changed my mind. But ended up choosing human rights as my major for my master's.
Okay, so that sounds like a really thoughtful decision-making process, right? Where you see you're doing something and it doesn't quite fit your needs. And so you made this decision to try and make the switch. Was your experience in London as you thought it would be? Did you have expectations of what life was going to be like in London? And did it meet your expectations?
I think with everything, it's never going to be your expectation. Like, regardless of whether your expectation was really good or really bad, it's always going to be a few points off either side. So I thought it was going to be amazing. So I get there in September. So bearing in mind, by this time, I think I was 26 or 27. So I was considered kind of a mature student. This was also the height of the housing crisis in the US was going on, affecting everybody. So a lot of kids ended up finishing their bachelor's in London and continuing on to do their master's. So my course, I think we had like 72 people. There were a lot of Americans, and they were all like really, really young, much younger than me, some of which already arrived with a master's as well. So there I was, like, just fresh out of the... Well, I wasn't even fresh out of the workforce. I'd been working for at least 3 to 5 years by that time. And so the first thing I noticed was getting there was the weather, which was horrible. And the lack of convenience, one would say. I wanted to go and buy bed sheets, I remember, and pillows. And it was such a struggle. So I remember being like really upset because it's like, oh, what, I left everything to come here and everything is so difficult. Like, and then there was a sense of profound kind of like loneliness because people aren't friendly either. And because you're not joining from bachelors where you have the same batchmates for like the next 4 years, you're basically all alone. So it was kind of bad in the first few months, I would say, but then it started getting progressively better.
I think that's a fairly normal experience for international students when they go to study abroad. I think the undergraduate and the master's experience tend to be quite different, but I don't know how you feel about this, but I think sometimes the older you are, the more difficult it is to adapt to a new place, right?
I think, I mean, I've always maintained that I had a very good undergraduate experience, and that is thanks to the fact that I had such amazing professors from USM and Taylor's, you know, like really helpful. And I felt like I learned a lot. And also, obviously, when the medium of instruction changed to English, there I was, you know, excelling, because I didn't do very well for SPM. Just so, parents, if you're listening, don't worry. But yeah, I went to LSE and I wasn't super impressed to begin with, because by that time I had been earning money, I had friends, I had a car, you know, I had a life. And then here I come, I'm living in a dorm room, you know, with people younger than me who are not cleaning up after themselves. Like, it was just like a weird experience. And everything was just so much harder. Like, I remember losing a button. And, you know, London is not a place where you can just walk into a mini market and, like, buy a needle and thread. You actually have to go to, like, a haberdashery. And I was like, this is not just from Enid Blyton books. Like, you actually have to go. So this was all very interesting, like in terms of the creature comfort thing. But the things started to change, I think, when my department, and a lot of people don't know about this, but the London School of, it's called the London School of Economics and Political Science. So I'm from the sociology department, and everybody started having this series of talks for the MSc in Human Rights program. And I think like the first guest that we had was Noam Chomsky. And I remember having wine with him later because, you know, they had invited him to, you know, hang out with us. And I was just terrified because I couldn't believe that Noam Chomsky was standing next to me. And then the same thing happened like a month or two later when they invited Amartya Sen. So it was just wild. Like, as much as I love my experience in Malaysia and stuff, I don't think this would be possible here. Nor in such a setting where, like, all of you are like, oh, please talk to Noam Chomsky. And there I was, like, just shaking in a corner because I don't want to talk to him, obviously. And I was just, you know, so impressed. And then I remember being in my dorm room and, you know, when you go, even now, when you Google and you go on JSTOR and, like, you cannot download this article because you have to buy it. And everything, every journal you opened, anything was, like, at your fingertips, whether you go to the library or in your dorm room. And I thought that was just fantastic. So I used to just read journal articles, like completely unrelated to what I was doing sometimes, just because I could, you know. And it's such a powerful experience, I think, to be given like so much knowledge just like that, you know. And then, of course, you know, I mean, I saved up my stipend, which was like, I think, £500 at the time. And traveled and like went to places all over Europe and things. And this was not something I ever saw myself doing, because this also coincided with the fact that the first few years of getting my journalist salary, I saved up and I finished Southeast Asia thanks to Tony Fernandez, yay, Air Asia. I mean, people can say whatever it is, but it really helped a lot of young people like me see the world. And then you go to London and then you can do the same as well, you know. So it was like, yeah, I learned a lot about myself. Definitely was such a scary experience, because a lot of these younger kids who came in to join me, they were super smart. Like, they would just drop names, you know, like when Rawls said this or when Heidegger said that. And I would be freaking out because I'm like, who is Heidegger? So, you know, there was a lot of reading and a lot of bringing myself up to speed. Yeah, and like understanding theory and things like that. I mean, there was also weird examples, of course, of, because this course is so, I mean, humanitarian field is generally kind of geared towards people from the quote-unquote Western world or the quote-unquote developed world or quote-unquote global north helping, you know, global south, underdeveloped, all these kind of things. So I would say there were a lot more people from Western countries, then I would say, you know, our Asian, African countries in the course. And the field itself suffers from this, as evidenced from a lot of the scandals that have happened in the past few years. The whole issue of, like, being a white savior and these things. So it's come up a lot in the media. So this was also something that we had to think about and talk about, because a lot of the theories that were being offered did not take into account how, let's say, Asians see themselves, or what actually happens in a Southeast Asian democracy, or what is ASEAN, you know. A lot of it was very much centered in about the British or the UK or Europe.
But going back to that whole thing of studying in the UK and, like, having access to, I suppose, leaders in their field, right? Because I had a very similar experience where I was studying international political economy for my master's in Manchester, and Joseph Stiglitz was coming to give a talk. And I was just like this insane fangirl. I was just like so excited just to meet someone that you only read about in books, or like you'd read their books and then you got to meet them. And then many years later, when I was at SOAS, going to an event where Amartya Sen was there, and actually having the courage to ask him about what he thought about how Mahathir dealt with the Asian financial crisis. And he just sort of, I think, was slightly stunned that someone asked him this question. But it just opens up doors, I think, that you can't really have here in Malaysia. Occasionally, you might have, you know, Michelle Obama swinging by, but it doesn't happen very often. I want to move on now, actually, to this career change, because like you, I actually did want to work in international aid. So the idea of going back to the UK to do a master's in a subject that I thought was relevant to international aid was, you know, so similar step, right? But I just caved. I found it too difficult to, like, try and find work in that sector. And I just sort of decided to stay in education. So how did you make this career change happen? Because it's quite difficult, I think.
It's very difficult. I mean, like I said, the industry, our industry, I call it an industry not because it's like for profit, but, you know, in the general sense of the term, because it's so centered, like I said, for of the haves helping the have-nots. So majority of the people doing it have always been traditionally coming from middle to upper class families, getting a leg in via, you know, family connections and different kinds of things. Being a certain nationality, you have to speak certain languages, none of which I had, by the way. I'm just like some random girl from Melati, you know, showing up. So it was really hard, because I remember going to a lot of the fairs in SOAS and LSE when they would have the, you know, humanitarian open days and stuff. So everybody would be there, MSF, the UN, the Red Cross, Amnesty. And like, if it was an unsaid thing, but it felt like you had to be a certain kind of person. Let's, you know, bear in mind that this was in 2009, 2010, before all this woke thing and all of this started happening. So it was very different. Even though it was not that long ago, it was a very different scene. And I was told by some organizations to go and, like, get more experience and go learn how to speak one of the UN languages.
That's actually exactly what I was told. And I was like,
Yeah, because I still remember, like, I tried, but my stipend, because I was fully on scholarship. My mom's a single mom, so we didn't have, like, cash lying around for me to go get extra language classes. And I remember trying to get them at LSE, and it was like, it wasn't exorbitant. It was, I think, probably subsidized, but it was still expensive. It still came up to, like, almost £200 to £300 or something like that, which I didn't have at the end of the month. And yeah, so it was virtually impossible. And then the languages that are part of the UN languages are not languages that would be cheap to learn in Malaysia either, because I then came home later on and ended up taking on French, for example. So I had to persevere a lot, I have to say. And because the Shivning kind of makes, they want you to come back to Malaysia, obviously, which I did. But at the time, a lot of us were also kind of applying to jobs in London. And it was really difficult because we never had this extra year that the British government used to give students who studied in the UK. And I remember sending around, it must have been 250 applications, and I got an answer to two. I mean, both of which were rejections. But yeah, it was super depressing. That's why when people go on about how everyone loves to be on welfare and don't like looking for jobs, I'm like, no, man, like, not having a job at your most qualified is one of the most depressing things in the world. Because you ask yourself, like, what am I really good for then, right? I was really lucky because I think at the same time, the organization that I currently work for, they opened up a branch in Malaysia. I mean, they had been open for a while, but this particular department that I'm in, protection, they were looking for people. So I made the decision to also come back to Malaysia and do the work here. So I abandoned the idea of doing it internationally for a while.
Yeah, I think for me, I guess that was the game changer because I actually wanted to stay abroad and everybody was just saying to me, absolutely not. So it's amazing that you came back to Malaysia to work here. One of the questions I want to explore, because I still sometimes don't really know what you do, even though we've been friends for years. What does an aid worker actually do?
Okay, for my particular organization, because we work primarily in conflict zones, and we call it other situations of violence. So you have migration contacts, for example, like Niger would be a great example where we work, Greece, where the migrants are being held, you know, things like that. Primarily in conflict zones, as evidenced by some of the places that I've been working. So in aid work, you always have this, every organization probably would have, to some extent, some overarching theme, and that would be the theme of protection. It's funny because a lot of people think that that means you're being a security guard. It's not. Protection in our field is the protection of civilians, basically. So what I do is I started in Malaysia working in primarily places of detention, so prisons as well as immigration detention centers. And I did that for about 5 years and eventually moved on to prisons in other places. So this is what I have chosen. It's very niche. There's so many other things you can do. There's a lot of people who do things on food, security, shelter. You have people who are just like anywhere else, admin or finance people. Yeah, so every organization has their own specialization. For example, everybody knows about UNHCR. They work primarily with refugees, asylum seekers. And then you have the food agencies. So you have people like FAO and things like that. So there's a lot of aspects. WFP obviously does other stuff as well. So it's about you finding like what you're really good at. And actually, in fact, people who do finance or HR or microeconomics, there's so many roles in all these organizations. It's not like you have to have a human rights degree or something. It's completely irrelevant. You could do law. You could do a variety of things, actually, and then kind of pick which area you want to go into. Because all these organizations are geared to, I mean, they're like any normal office, basically, you know.
So you've sort of answered my next question, which was like, what should I study if I want to become an aid worker? It sounds like we have a fairly broad range of degrees that one could choose from. But also, I suppose, one of the things that I picked up over the years with, you know, having considered the idea of working as in international aid is that language skills are valuable.
Yeah, I would say if you have interest in the Middle East or the Americas, probably you would be good looking into Arabic, Spanish. I have a Malaysian colleague actually who speaks fluent Spanish. So she's been to Colombia. And I think it's really important if you want to have a foot ahead. Of course, French is one of the main spoken languages. This is more for rubbing shoulders, obviously. Because if you're going to be based in Geneva, where a lot of these discussions takes place, a lot of the headquarters are, yeah, then you probably would, it would be good to have a working knowledge of French. But frankly, more and more when I attend meetings there, it's turned into also English. It's not as strict as it used to be before. And I would say also, my biggest regret, frankly speaking, is not doing a more vocational degree. I mean, of course, I cannot go back and change it. Like, I could probably try and do something now. But I really admire my colleagues in, we call it water and habitat, but in our industry, it's called WASH, so water and shelter. Because they come from architecture, they come from electrical engineering, urban design, and like a lot of interesting things, because you have to also look at the next phase after the conflict. The reverse is true. Most people don't really work in the, I mean, there's a lot of attention on countries during the emergency phase, but then people get tired because there's also like a lot of conflict fatigue and donation fatigue and stuff. So then moving into post-emergency, or they call it post-conflict. But again, a lot of these conflicts nowadays are protracted, you know. Mm-hmm. Syria is like past its 10th year now of the conflict. So there's a lot of people needed for further efforts into ensuring that people continue to be safe in the reconstruction period of their lives. And so there's a lot of technical jobs that continue to be, I mean, it's very difficult to find people to leave, you know, their life and come and do this kind of work as well. Also, I mean, doctors, a lot of them have asked me like, oh, is that the only thing you guys do? Actually, it's not. Like, a lot of people immediately think these jobs must be for doctors, and that's not necessarily true. The only one kind of like fully engaged in the health, public health aspect of stuff like this is probably MSF, for example. But even them, you know, they have their own humanitarian specialists, protection specialists, admin, finance. So actually, any of your professions, probably you could find something. It's a matter of also having certain qualities as a person, the language skills, and some relevant experience, which you can start getting, I suppose, in local organizations as well.
So what are those qualities that you think are necessary? Clearly, I can't do it because I'm not perseverant.
I think we always have this discussion, Davina. I think anyone can do it if they really want to, but you disagree with me. It is difficult. Also, specifically, I mean, if you're going to work in the UN in Geneva, of course, you know, like your life is not under threat or anything. But there are, I mean, if you're going to think of going to Yemen or, you know, some of the tougher places, I would say that, yeah, you probably need to be mentally ready. I think one thing for me, and it's also like how I make friends in the industry, is also looking at people with a lot of strength of character. I don't even know how do you explain that. It's like people who carry themselves with integrity. Yeah, these things are kind of important because you're dealing with, I don't want to use any terminology that kind of puts people into like victim tropes, but you're dealing with a lot of people that have been through a lot of terrible things. So it's also important to have a great deal of humility, but also not take away agency from these people, because they know their problems, they know their lives better than you can, you know. So I think it's something that a lot of us have to kind of learn as well, to go to the affected populations and actually include them in discussions has been also a huge shift from how we used to all do this work, you know, all the organizations, because it used to be like, let me tell you what I think you need.
So very top down, exactly. Previously versus a more sort of like inclusive approach to work. So you've been in lots of different countries around the world doing what you do. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about some highs and lows of your time abroad.
There's a lot, obviously. The most recent high was actually building a bakery in Syria, in my area which I was managing. So I was a head of office, which meant like basically liaising with the local authorities, everybody to work on projects that would help the local population. So including other agencies, other departments, government officials, the governor, etc. I absolutely loved it. I think it appeals to my sense of organizing everything and like being very rigid about this kind of stuff. So we managed to actually, at a time where there was a lot of food insecurity, repair a bakery line and ended up giving or providing enough bread for 70,000 people in that area. So that was like huge. I was really proud of the team. It was fairly amazing, I think, to see that people were like, it's instantaneous results. So that was nice. But I had also moved, because I've been with the same organization now for almost 11 years. But when I started off, I was obviously junior. So I had much less responsibilities than I just did as a manager. So when I was younger, it was like, because protection is a very tough department to be in. And primarily you're dealing with a lot of people who've lost their relatives either through war, conflict or migration. People who are sitting in detention centers with no contact, you know, these are the things that we used to have to do. And it's quite sad, lah, because when you go to meet these people, you take their messages for their families and stuff like that, and then you help them search for their families with all our local partners and stuff. And in some cases, you have to go back and tell them like, oh, actually, we didn't find your son. Or in some of the cases, in some of the countries we have been, where people are already kind of buried in unmarked graves. And some of these families will never see their relatives again. And they will live with this feeling of not knowing. I think it's called, it's like an ambiguous loss. So you don't have a body. You don't have any form of... So one of the work that my organization does is also to kind of help these families through the psychosocial aspect of living with ambiguous loss, for example.
Yeah, that sounds tough. And so this is why whenever we talk about like who can do this work, we always disagree, because I just don't think everybody's cut out for it. I think that you have to be a certain kind of person who is mentally strong and can deal with situations like this with empathy and kindness and, like you said, humility, you know? Can we talk a little bit about, I suppose, regret, if that's the right word? Like, would you do anything differently?
Yes, I think this relates back again to what I was saying earlier. It was so funny because I remember being in Syria and talking to one of these super high-level officials and stuff in the course of my work. And he's a doctor and he was there, you know, during the war and stuff like that. And Syrians are very much like Malaysians in that it's the, you know, the trifecta, right? Lawyer, doctor, engineer. And there it's like even higher because like they have engineers, clubs and things like that, you know. And he's like, oh, what's your degree? And I'm like, journalism and human rights. And it just felt so frou-frou, you know, like, God, why? Like, I could have said plumber or something and he would be more impressed. So, yeah, I think that's kind of like a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. I think it also goes back to the Malaysian education system, right? Because I was in science stream, right, which is where they chucked all of us who were doing marginally better than everyone. And it took so much of guts to tell your parents, like, hey, I don't want to go to science stream. I want to go to art stream because...
Yeah, so you know, going back to that whole thing about perception about science and arts, I think it's definitely still the case.
Is it?
In Malaysia. Yes, 100%. I mean,
so I left school, what, 21 years ago? So yeah, great.
No, I think I often find it quite shocking. Like, so, you know, I worked at Maybex. I did a law degree and then I came back and worked at Maybex for 4 years. And at the time, just being quite surprised by the types of subjects that people were studying. And this is like a long time ago. And then to go abroad for like, I don't know, 12, 13 years, come back to Maybex and realize that people are still studying the same subjects. And there's this general perception that like if you're doing science, you're that bit smarter than the people doing.
No, and it's terrible. It's such a debilitating thing because there's literally no option. Like I think I would have fared so much better. I mean, I'm just full disclosure. Like my mom's gotten over it, thank God. But like I got 2 A's from my SPM, you know.
So did I. Yes. I mean, I'm going to start calling it the 2A club, like the 2A's club.
Yeah, because I remember my mom calling me, crying, you know, like, because it was literally such a big deal back then.
Because it's still a big deal now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I know. And then I laugh because I'm like, haha, I shouldn't be saying this, but anyway.
No, you should, because I think it's exactly the kind of conversations we should be having. I spoke to someone last weekend who ended up studying at Oxford, who also got 2 A's for SPM. And we were just laughing about it because it was that decision when you finish your Form 3, whatever, you know, you get your straight A's, and then everybody sort of pigeonholes you and says you should be in the science stream, even though, like, I can't count for peanuts. I should not be doing additional mathematics. Like, I am terrible. I'll tell you, when I did physics, after the first 6 months of physics in Form 4, I was just like, you know what? I have absolutely no idea what's going on in class.
That was the only thing I could do well in, because there was some small addition. But at maths, I failed it. Like, I just failed it.
Yeah, no, I hated physics. And I ended up sitting for my SPM exam without studying at all, because I was like, I don't know what's going on. I'll never know what's going on. So I don't know why I'm bothering. And then subsequently, like, making the switch to humanities, that was life-changing for me, because then I excelled, because that's how my brain works. And so it's these conversations that we need to keep having, so that parents and students don't feel like there's only one path that they should pursue. So I feel this falls into the category of general life advice to young people. Like, do what makes you happy.
Okay, my main thing is, I don't think you're going to be able to be saved from the whole SPM thing. So if you're coming from a family that has some savings, like, maybe think very carefully about... Because I think the fact that there's not enough placements in university, which is a whole other story.
Yes, not one for today.
Exactly. That is one thing that makes all of us feel so badly when we're doing our SPM, right? Because your parents are like, get into a uni. I mean, what is that, like 14 public unis, or maybe it's increased since. So spaces are limited, obviously, right? And then if you don't have that much money, your parents are going to have to fork out, I don't know what it is now, for an undergrad degree. So these are a lot of considerations that parents are thinking of, obviously. And then if you have money, you want to choose the right course, because your parents are like literally using their life savings to send you to the UK. So I would say, me now, if I had a child, I would say, like I said earlier, pick something vocational, because, I mean, this is a bit cynical or doom and gloom on my behalf, lah. But I think we're headed down a path where a lot of things like agriculture, a lot of things like food science, and these things are more interesting now because we are living in an era where climate change is literally a looming threat. You know, we have more and more of these things going on. So frankly speaking, in 20 or 30 years, when, you know, some horrible disasters, if you look at this current pandemic that we're sitting in, you know, thinking of studies in epidemiology, if you're so inclined to medicine, would be amazing. Or looking at studies about water is going to be a massive, massive issue. So having someone who knows what's going to happen to the water table in Malaysia, yes, I would be very happy. And I think parents should be kind of like asking children these larger questions. Like, dinner table conversations should be about stuff like this that's going to happen and is happening in our current, in society. And I found that, and I think you as well, Davina, because you and I are voracious readers. We read a lot. So this is another thing that I think parents need to start, like, it's not enough to ask your kids to go to school or send them to all these things, but they're not doing enough of the readings that they should in their spare time. I think that's helped me a lot, you know. I mean, otherwise you'd be left with thinking, oh my God, you're the girl who got like 2 A's for her SPM, which then makes you feel bad because you're like, oh my God, maybe I'm not that smart. And then you and I realize that actually, no, when you set us in another stream of education, something that we preferred more, we excelled, right? But we also excelled because I suspect we did a lot of reading that made us able to answer different questions and develop a kind of sense of character or morality or ideas about the world, which come in very useful later.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. Recently, one of my colleagues was asked, like, oh, how do you make sure, like, that my kid can get into Oxford or Cambridge? And her response was, kena baca buku. Kalau tak baca buku, susah sikit. And I think that's spot on. Like, you've got to, I mean, I feel constantly grateful for the fact that my parents were very encouraging from a young age that I should read. And that habit has stuck with me over the years. And even then, you know, going back to what you said about when you were doing your master's and like people quoting like philosophers that you've never heard of. And I just remember thinking that in my first year of university, like the first term, sitting in law seminars, kind of going, who? I don't know who any of these people are. Like, what are we talking about, you know? And then subsequently being pushed to read more, to understand more so that you're not the like class idiot. So yeah, I mean, that needs to start from a young age.
I think strength of character is super important. I don't even, how do you do that to a child? How do you teach them? So I can't really comment, but I would say like parents should probably start like, because you find a lot of like, you know, we complain a lot now, like, oh, look at all these people in power, so insipid, don't know how to do this. So the question is also like, how are we raising our younger generation? But you should be kind of now already developing, you know, moral character, strength of character, things that will last you in good stead. So my key here for parents and students to think about is longevity. So how are you going to make it? Go learn something very useful that you can use in the coming 20 to 30 years. And also develop skills in your personality and your character that are going to help you navigate a world that even for me, sometimes I'm like, what is going on? So I think that's really important.
Okay, so I think we've covered pretty much everything that we wanted to talk about today. So I would like to thank you, Michelle, for joining us and for being our first guest. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast today, and we look forward to seeing you again in our next episode. Thank you.